China's latest crackdown on Hong Kong is one of those news stories which can be readily classified as shocking but not surprising. It's an extension of a pattern of recent behaviour. So, too, it can be plausibly reasoned, are such gestures as incursions by the People's Liberation Army across China's disputed border with India, an escalation of saber-rattling in the direction of Taiwan, and the provocation of a minor trade war with Australia. These are all the actions of an assertive nation testing the limits of its power and testing also the willingness of other countries to push back. But is there a reason why all of the above and more besides is happening right now? Is Beijing calculating that a world distracted by the COVID-19 pandemic is paying its belligerents less attention than it otherwise would? China hasn't gone rogue overnight. This is a country which was already interring its own citizens by the hundreds of thousands for observing a religious faith of which the Communist Party disapproves. But is China arguably going roguier? Does China think that it can now do as it pleases? If so, is it wrong? How and where else is China likely to try its luck? And what useful options do other countries have for responding? This is the Foreign Desk.
When it comes to Hong Kong or Taiwan or Xinjiang or Tibet, China is very consistent. It deems these places to be Chinese territory. This is a domestic issue. It's not going to listen to any foreign interference.
Xi Jinping is pushing his brand of authoritarian governance as an alternative to Western-style democracy. In many ways, this is very attractive. China did what the Western world thought was impossible, which is to build a robust economy under authoritarian rule. And for loads of dictators around the world, this looks great. They're tired of the U.S. swinging their weight around, talking about values. So this is a very dangerous place to be for the world.
China is at severe risk of overplaying its hand. It suffers severe economic problems of its own. Its political structures are ramshackle and fragile. There's a real risk, I think, that China simply overreaches itself, stumbles, and then lashes out to try to distract attention. It's not China's strength, but China's weakness that's the real threat.
Welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. We'll go first of all to James Chambers, Monocle's Asia editor and Hong Kong bureau chief. James joins us from Hong Kong, where China intends to impose a new national security law, which will criminalise anything that China decides amounts to undermining China and may allow Chinese state security organisations to operate in Hong Kong. James, first of all, just bring us up to date. What has been happening in Hong Kong this week?
It's been a busy week in Hong Kong. We were already expecting to have some protests because there was this reading of the national anthem law taking place in the local parliament here. So when the Beijing National People's Congress dropped the surprise national security bill on us, we knew that it would be a bit of a double header. So we had protests about the security bill, and then we had protests about the National Anthem Bill.
Well, let's talk a bit about those two bills. First, the National Anthem Bill. What actually is it and what is it practically going to mean?
So the National Anthem Bill is some legislation that Beijing brought in 2017. So they passed the law for the mainland China to essentially say that you have to respect the Chinese national anthem, which is called the March of the Volunteers. So you can't parody it or you can't boo it at a sporting event. And obviously Beijing brought that in and they passed that without any problems on the mainland. But the way they decided to implement it in Hong Kong is that they allowed the Hong Kong government to pass local legislation to bring it into effect. But the fact that it still hasn't passed in 2020 shows how slow the lawmaking process can be in a kind of a quasi-democratic system like Hong Kong has. So now, when the parliament here came back after COVID-19, the National Anthem Bill was put at the top, and that was the priority. So the local lawmakers here on the pro-Beijing side are having the second reading of that, and they're expecting to have a vote on it on June the 4th next week, which whether it's coincidence or timing, is also the same day as the annual vigil for the Tiananmen Square massacre.
I mean, the National Anthem Bill sounds like one of those fairly silly cosmetic rules which are often deployed by authoritarian governments of all kinds. The National Security Bill, though, might be a bit more serious for Hong Kong and its future status, right?
That's definitely correct. I mean, when the National Security Bill was announced, it, you know, caused huge shockwaves in Hong Kong. It took everybody by surprise. And for, I mean, a lot of us here, it is a game changer, because I guess the National Anthem Bill provides a nice contrast, because they're both laws that the Chinese want to bring in. In the National Anthem Bill, they tried to follow the proper procedure, but they couldn't rely on the Hong Kong government to bring it in. So with the National Security Bill, they've just circumvented all that. They've just decided to bypass the basic law, the Hong Kong Constitution, the Hong Kong government, and just bring it in themselves. So that's why everybody is up in arms, because it does feel like they're essentially ripping up this one country, two systems agreement. They're directly legislating on something that the Hong Kong government was meant to do themselves. So even though the bill itself does sound quite sinister, because it's meant to stop things like secession and treason and all this kinds of stuff, it's actually a bill that was meant to be brought in 1997. So it's not necessarily the subject of the bill that people should be focusing on. It's the fact that the Communist Party have essentially just ripped up the arrangement with Hong Kong, essentially trampled all over the constitution and changed everything in terms of how they govern Hong Kong.
Because what we're looking into in this episode, I guess, is whether China is doing more things and doing them faster because it perceives an opportunity, that while the world is distracted by the COVID-19 pandemic, the world is perhaps paying less attention to China's various assertive machinations than it otherwise might. Is that how this is being seen in Hong Kong, or do people think that this is China acting according to a plan it had anyway?
I definitely and wholeheartedly disagree with this kind of narrative that's being spun, that China is in any way reacting to COVID-19 and essentially using the pandemic to squeeze in some, you know, rather odious new laws. I just don't believe that's how the Chinese Communist Party behaves. It's not opportunistic in that way. If anything, I would say that these measures have probably been delayed by COVID-19 and not accelerated. The National People's Congress is the annual meeting where the rubber stamp parliament, where they will advance and introduce and pass laws in China, and that's meant to happen in March. So that was delayed by 2 months. And the funny thing about the Communist Party is that they do like to appear to be following the rules. They do like to pretend that they do things by the book. So the way I see it is that there was these big protests in Hong Kong last year, and we were all waiting. I mean, one of the most popular talking points was, what's China going to do? You know, they're going to have to do something. How is Beijing going to react? And I guess a lot of the fear-mongering was around, is the army going to leave the garrison in Admiralty and come out onto the streets and basically take over Hong Kong by force? That didn't happen. And so I guess a lot of people stopped thinking about what Beijing would do and thought the whole thing had gone away. But obviously, they had, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about how they could end these protests, and this National Security Bill is what Beijing was going to do to end these protests. So I don't think it's a case of them trying to do something under the cover of COVID-19. I think the only people who are potentially using that as a tool is Donald Trump and Washington to kind of fan this anti-China rhetoric. So I think where we've got to these days is that Beijing, President Xi Jinping, China, they just feel strong enough and assertive enough to do what they want, and when they feel like they need to. And in this case, they felt like they needed to do something to stop the protests, and this is what they decided to do.
Well, you mentioned Washington there, and of course, Washington has paid an amount of attention to what China has been doing in Hong Kong these last few weeks, to the extent that, as you know, this week, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said that he has reported to Congress that given the facts on the ground, Hong Kong is no longer autonomous from China. He went on to say that the United States stands with the people of Hong Kong. It remains, of course, to be seen what that might actually mean in practice. But how interested is China at this point in what the United States thinks about its behaviour towards Hong Kong, or indeed its behaviour anywhere else?
I guess when it comes to Hong Kong or Taiwan or Xinjiang or Tibet, the Communist Party is very consistent. It deems these places to be Chinese territory. This is a domestic issue. It says it's not going to listen to any what they call foreign interference on these matters. So when it comes to this security bill, they decided to take action. And even though the US has responded with some potentially very aggressive measures that are equally shocking for the people of Hong Kong, it's not going to budge Beijing. The National People's Congress is a rubber stamp parliament. This decision has already been made. It's going to happen. But obviously, China does care what the world thinks, and it will listen in other areas, like we saw at the WHO about COVID-19, and like we saw on the trade war. China can be influenced in other areas, but it does have a what they would call a bottom line when it comes to its own domestic affairs.
James Chambers in Hong Kong, thanks for joining us. It's not just Hong Kong, of course. China has been asserting itself in its own region and around the world with increasing confidence in recent years. China often encounters resistance, whether economic or diplomatic, but might Beijing have calculated that right now, for obvious reasons, it will encounter less? I'm joined from Beijing by Sophia Yan, Beijing correspondent for The Telegraph. Sophia, we just heard from James Chambers in our Hong Kong bureau. James was other than convinced by the thesis we're pursuing here, that China is using the COVID-19 pandemic as a cover for ramping up various diplomatic and strategic initiatives. There is nevertheless a fairly widespread pattern of expansive behaviour by China, not just in Hong Kong, but elsewhere. Do you get the sense that there is a concerted stepping up, or is this all just business as usual?
These diplomatic spats that you've mentioned have been brewing for some time, and they are finally coming to a head at the moment. Keep in mind the position that China's in now. Beijing is trying to shore up its image abroad and at home. President Xi Jinping is facing many, many challenges, and the coronavirus pandemic is an excellent opportunity to flex some muscle. The rest of the world is distracted right now with this global health crisis and the ensuing economic fallout. And so China can slot in a couple of things that it perhaps normally wouldn't be able to get away with. And again, these are things that have been around for some time, and for whatever reason, they are just all piling in at this one particular moment.
Well, let's look at a few of them individually. What do we know for certain about the incursions by the People's Liberation Army towards, on, or indeed over the Indian border?
Well, for decades, China and India have never actually agreed on the border. There have been clashes many, many times over the years, decades of simmering tensions, and this, quote, line of actual control in some ways doesn't actually exist because it remains in dispute. This time around, it seems like China has been responding to what's been increased infrastructure building activity, road building, and this construction activity lies on the side that India believes it's its own, and China sees this as challenging Beijing's position on where it thinks the border is. There's also a broader strategic geopolitical calculation here, and China is perhaps responding to deteriorating ties between China and India. There have been a lot of very vocal state media editorials in recent days, the struggle for dominance. One said, quote, India's attempt to replace China is self-righteous. So the view from Beijing is trying to poke at India. India, also a rising, developing nation, one potential competition at odds with China. And because it shares a border, what Beijing really wants to do is to make sure it can keep its neighbor at bay.
Well, if we look at Taiwan then, and obviously it's far from unusual for China to flex in the direction of Taiwan. But again, there seems to be an amount of stepping up, you know, sending aircraft carriers to participate in this exercise simulating an invasion of the Dongsha Islands and so forth. Again, is this business as usual, or is China thinking we can lean on Taiwan a bit harder than we normally might and no one's going to stop us?
What was notable over this last week with regard to Taiwan is what China didn't say. For the first time in quite a while, China didn't use the word peaceful when talking about reunification with Taiwan. And this is during Beijing's annual rubber stamp parliament meetings. And so this was a very notable removal in the language. And this does come after a period of time when the Chinese military has been flying fighter jets to assert its sovereignty over Taiwan. Now, this is also coming in relation to the Hong Kong situation. Right now, Beijing is very keen to quash any notion of independence. After months and months of unrest in Hong Kong, Beijing is moving to try to bring that under control. And with democratically elected Taiwanese president Tsai Ing-wen just beginning her second term very recently, this is prime time for Beijing to be, again, flexing its muscle and just reminding Taiwan that, hey, any idea that they have about trying to keep up their idea of democracy, that's just something that Beijing will not tolerate. Taiwan, on the other hand, of course, sees it very, very differently. They've had many years of a robust democracy, and the political system has continued to develop in a way that Beijing never anticipated.
Well, if we look even further afield, and this is a diplomatic row which does seem pretty intimately connected to COVID-19, and this is the trade war that China appears to be trying to pick with Australia. Is that a straightforward response to Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison trying to gather support for an international investigation into COVID-19, an international investigation which, by the way, he does want China to participate in? Or again, is this China pushing at Australia for some other reason?
Well, Australia was among many nations pressing for an international inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus, and that inflamed tensions that were already pretty rocky. China, for the last few years, has been quite upset with Australia as the first country to ban Chinese telecom firm Huawei from having a role in building Australia's 5G networks. There are many security concerns here. And then the U.S. started picking at this issue too, trying to persuade other nations to also exclude 5G. So from Beijing's perspective, Australia is a lapdog of the U.S. and has been trying to pressure Canberra into behaving itself too. There's a sphere of influence across Asia Pacific that China is always trying to influence and encourage and persuade nations to swing their way. And this is one such issue. So a trade spat was already in the works as part of Beijing's campaign to pressure over what started as the Huawei issue. Again, the virus situation didn't help. China did earlier launch an anti-dumping investigation into Australia and has now imposed tariffs of 80% on barley imports. So it's quite convenient timing, but Beijing will always be strategic. Beijing can live for now without Australian barley, and there's even talk of going after coal. That's an important natural resource, but Beijing wants to wean the country off export reliance and build its own domestic industry. So it's a diplomatic spat that's all wrapped up in what works well for China. Beijing's not likely to go after the really key trade items, the top shelf natural resources that Australia exports, like iron ore or gas.
Well, as a final thought then, and on that idea of the Chinese Communist Party's strategic thinking, there is a conventional wisdom that, you know, unlike political parties in democratic nations, which have to put themselves through the regular nuisance of running for re-election, the Chinese Communist Party can afford to think a long way ahead. And there is this idea that it does think in terms of decades, even centuries. If we look at the activity that we have been discussing today, do we understand yet what any of this means for the world outside China? How does China want things to be different, say 5 or 10 years from now?
Well, the global world order could shift entirely. No more talk of a rules-based international order, but one based on different interpretations and factions going after what they think is their right. Xi Jinping is pushing his brand of authoritarian governance as an alternative to Western-style democracy. In many ways, this is very attractive. China did what the Western world thought was absolutely impossible, which is to build a robust economy under authoritarian rule. And for loads of dictators around the world, this looks great. They're tired of the U.S. swinging their weight around talking about values. So this is a very dangerous place to be for the world. Arguably, so many decades of world order and peace has been because of the U.S. and other like-minded Western nations throwing that weight around. Every so often, there's another proxy or some sort of facet expanding this broader U.S.-China battle. Disagreement on how to curb North Korea's nuclear tendencies, South China Sea territorial disputes, the trade war, now the coronavirus and influence at the World Health Organization. Clearly, the world is becoming very, very polarized, and nations are getting pushed into either the U.S. corner or the China corner, and that's a very, very volatile place to be.
Sophia Yan in Beijing, thanks for joining us. Even before COVID-19 emerged from Wuhan, the world was learning that it is not easy to stop an economic and military superpower of 1.4 billion people from doing as it pleases. For a look at what practical options are available to policymakers hoping to persuade China, I'm joined by former British diplomat John Everard, who, among a varied career on Her Majesty's service, worked in the UK's embassy in Beijing. John, let's start with being a diplomat in China and what that's like. You've been a diplomat in a number of locales, including but not limited to Belarus, Uruguay, North Korea, and the People's Republic of China. So there is a broad sweep there from the hospitable to the perhaps less so. Where does Beijing rank as a diplomatic environment?
In terms of creature comforts, it ranks very highly. I mean, it's well developed, everything's there. In terms of interacting with a government, there are easier places, we say. This is a country that's on a roll and isn't to be told what to do by anybody. And I served in China twice, and the difference in tone in dealing with the Chinese ministry on both occasions was quite noticeable. The first time round, the Chinese were still a little bit unsure of themselves and about their place in the world. Second time round, they were much more aggressive, much tougher. Dealing with them right now must be extremely difficult.
Well, this is kind of what we wanted to get into. It's the practicalities of diplomacy when dealing with China, which is now this country of just the most extraordinary heft in every department, military, economic, diplomatic, cultural, to say nothing of its 1.5 billion people. If you want to persuade China to do something other than what China is clearly intent on doing, what options actually are there?
You don't have a lot. You can apply some economic pressure, but if you do that, China is likely simply to apply economic pressure back. You can appeal to China's very considerable self-esteem, prestige in the world, but the way things are right now, China has got most of what it wants, and trying to use that lever is unlikely to get you very far. It depends what you want China to do. When it comes to things like Hong Kong, which in China's eyes are part of a sacred mission, China's willingness to take any kind of advice from anybody is much lower than if you're dealing with some other areas.
Well, if we think about this in terms of sticks and carrots, which I realise is a crude delineation of the diplomatic toolbox, but let's look at carrots first. You say China has most of what it wants anyway, and it certainly has the wherewithal to take whatever else it might want. What actual positive reinforcements are there if you're trying to induce changes of behaviour from China?
Yeah, we are very short of carrots. You used to be able to offer China a greater role in international institutions and various economic benefits. But as I said earlier, it's got pretty much all it wants in those areas. Sticks, you don't have a lot of sticks either. You can threaten economic reprisals, but as I said, you risk getting the same back.
Is there anything to then, and I'm not sure whether this is a carrot or a stick or something in between, the suggestion which has emerged that the UK government might extend the visa rights of the 300,000 or so British overseas passport holders resident in Hong Kong, that they'll extend their visa-free ability to stay in the UK from 6 months to 12. Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, even suggesting that they may look at instituting a path to actual British citizenship. Now, obviously, the threat here, at least as I see it, is to dig a conduit for a brain drain out of Hong Kong, would that bother China in the slightest?
Yes, it will bother it. And it's quite a serious threat. That's a lot of people, a lot of highly qualified people who potentially will leave Hong Kong. But we are dealing here with China's sacred historical mission of national reunification. And I just don't think that that kind of threat by itself is going to be anything like enough to persuade China to change course.
This is, of course, a threat and or promise being made by Britain, with whom it's fair to say China has a history. Are there some countries, because of various interactions over the centuries, that China is more likely to listen to than others? Because China does not regard its treatment by Britain over the centuries with any great fondness. Does that come up when you're trying to deal with China?
Oh, yes. The Opium Wars and national humiliation and how badly we treated them. That comes up quite often. Is there any country they're more likely to listen to? They used to listen to the United States. One of the big changes we've seen in recent months is that as the government has, how should we put this, perhaps lost its grip on certain issues, they've listened to Washington a great deal less. They still listen a bit to the European Union because they need European trade, but the European Union is most unlikely to weigh in and get heavy with China over Hong Kong. So if your question is, are there countries they're going to listen to over Hong Kong and pay attention to, the answer is no.
Whether you present yourself as a diplomat or a foreign government brandishing sticks or offering carrots to China, does the tone with which you do it matter? There's this idea at large that China places far greater store than many other countries on questions of courtesy and face and so forth. Is there anything to that, or is this just Orientalist nonsense?
No, there's a lot of truth to that. Any statement that you make is parsed very, very carefully by the Chinese, who will compare it with previous statements word by word to see the vocabulary. Tone is very important, both in dealing with China and if you listen to the debates in the National People's Congress within China too. Chinese are acutely sensitive to the way they're being spoken to. Tone is related to face, to self-image, to the relationship that you have with the person. And relationships are all important in Chinese society and in Chinese diplomacy. That's not to say that they care so much about tone that a change in tone is actually going to make the difference in changing their behavior.
So do we therefore basically just have to get used to the idea at this point that this is pretty much going to be China's world and the rest of us are living in it?
No, this isn't China's world. China is on a roll. China believes that it's come out of the COVID crisis looking much better than the Western powers. It believes that the United States is run by an idiot and that it can do what it likes. And it believes that the international community as a whole is too preoccupied to worry about what China is doing, and it will push. But China is at severe risk of overplaying its hand. It suffers severe economic problems of its own. Its political structures are ramshackle and fragile. And there's a real risk, I think, that China simply overreaches itself, stumbles, and then lashes out to try to distract attention. In a curious sense, it's not China's strength, but China's weakness that's the real threat.
So to return finally to the reason for this episode, if you were put in charge of trying to get China to give Hong Kong a bit of a break, what would you actually do? What sort of strategy do you think would work?
You need to act quickly now while the legislation is still being drafted. I think that Mike Pompeo's announcement that the United States no longer regards Hong Kong as autonomous from China, so it'll be treated in the same way as trade, which has produced fury in Beijing. But that kind of short, sharp shock does have an effect. Likewise, the British announcement that they are considering extending effectively a path of British nationality to a lot of important Hong Kongs, that will have an effect too. But it's probably more important to play the long game, to maintain support for Hong Kong, to make clear to the democracy protesters who are not going to go away that the world is watching, and to force China over time, bit by bit, to back down.
John Everard, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolene Goffin and edited by Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.